I'm Greya, and this is The Climate Question, where we ask simply, what on earth can we do about climate change? Podcasts from the BBC World Service are supported by advertising.
Shorter growing seasons, longer heat waves, water gone wild, tens of millions of migrants flooding into coastal areas at the very time sea levels are rising.
These are just some of the apocalyptic prospects for Africa, according to the world's leading climate scientists.
Some of those same experts say Africa's costs to deal with the climate emergency will only balloon in the coming years.
The world's best shot at heading off disaster? The big annual climate talks called COP. They were held in Africa earlier this month in the Red Sea resort of Sharm el-Sheikh in Egypt.
And from that giant, diverse continent, leaders brought a unified message.
The host, Egypt's president, Abdel Fattah el-Sisi, said it was especially important for African countries to receive appropriate support and funding from the rest of the world.
Le financement cumulé de l'adaptation prévue avant 2030.
The chair of the African Union, which represents 55 countries in Africa, Senegal's president Macky Sall, said Africa's only receiving a quarter of the money it needs to adapt to the warming world. He called for nations to, quote, make history by shouldering and honoring their financial commitments.
Gabon's president Ali Bongo Ondimba talked about the crucial question of financing climate action.
On it went, all very polite and diplomatic, but the message was blunt. Show us the money now.
So we're asking, did Africa's COP deliver for Africa?
That's our focus on The Climate Question from the BBC World Service.
With Greya Jackson and Neil Rozell. Now, here's something that we don't get to do very often. That's talk to our esteemed colleague, Peter Okwuche, host of the BBC's daily TV show, Focus on Africa.
We invited Peter into our studio because to answer our question, we need to know what climate change is already doing to Africa. And Peter says he sees it every day.
The African continent has been ravaged by climate change. And if you look at this year alone, in the east of Africa, the Horn of Africa, so Somalia, parts of Kenya, parts of Sudan, they are now going through their fifth consecutive year without rains. Thousands of children are dying by the day. Now, if you cross to the west of the continent, Niger, Chad, Ghana, those countries have been inundated by some of the worst floods in decades, you know, claiming lives, ruining arable land, so there's going to be a food shortage in the future in these countries. The Sahara Desert, the largest hot desert in the world, is expanding by, we're told, almost 10 kilometers every single decade. So it's expanding into arable land. This is causing people to leave their homesteads and move further south in search of arable land and grazing fields for their animal. This tends to start different kinds of conflicts. So if you look at the conflicts in parts of northern Nigeria, in parts of Burkina Faso, in parts of Mali, the root causes of most of these conflicts can be traced back to climate change.
Now, of course, we can't put all of Africa's problems at the feet of climate change, but there is a pattern.
And there was no shortage of big-sounding promises at COP to tackle it.
$1.4 billion for the next 5 years.
1.8 billion euros by 2025.
$11 billion annually by 2024.
£11.6 billion.
Indeed, those sums sound huge. But how do they sit next to a problem as big as climate change?
Well, the Climate Policy Initiative has helpfully totted up all of Africa's climate needs. They're an international climate policy think tank based in San Francisco, by the way. And they say the total is...
Probably best to sit down for this one.
Yeah, because it's $2.8 trillion.
The number is almost incomprehensible and it shows you the scale and the magnitude of the problem that we're trying to face.
That's Jude Moore, a former Liberian government minister, now senior policy fellow for the Center for Global Development in Washington, from where he's speaking to us. Welcome, Jude.
Hello, everybody. It's a pleasure to be here.
We've heard Africans are getting nowhere near this sum. I mean, what's your estimate as to how much Africa currently gets?
The annual need in terms of mitigation adaptation in Africa is around $277 billion over a decade. That's 2.8 trillion. And the research shows that the continent gets around 30 billion of that.
Right. So by that estimate, 10% of what they need.
How capable is Africa of helping itself on this front rather than relying on outside help?
The capacity of African governments to self-heal, I guess, and solve this problem has been significantly diminished by the last 3 years and the cascading crises. So first, it was the COVID crisis. Because of lack of access to vaccines, many African countries were not able to return to full economic activity at the same time as their counterparts in other parts of the world did. And so the African countries were still counting the cost of the pandemic when the Russian invasion of Ukraine and all of the economic fallout that has come out of that. All of that comes on the heel of Africa having very little savings, right? And so because the savings on the continent is low, Africa has historically looked elsewhere for investment. So Africa's need for external investment has always been there, and it's only been worsened by what we've seen over the last 3 years, meaning that Africa's ability to do the large-scale things that are required to adapt to and mitigate the effects of climate change is diminished.
Listening into Jude is Ayan Adam in Lagos, Nigeria. She's a senior director with the Africa Finance Corporation.
It was set up by African governments to channel money towards infrastructure projects across the continent.
It's wonderful to be here. Thank you. What can Africa do to help itself? Actually, Africa has led the charge in the transition. A significant amount of African institutions have really supported the move towards renewable energy and cutting of carbon. We can do more. The idea is not for Africa to rely on others to come and solve its problems, but we also want to have private capital flow to Africa because it hasn't flown.
And this is important because when we talk about climate finance, a lot of attention goes to money governments give directly or indirectly through institutions like the World Bank or Africa Development Bank.
But those sums are dwarfed by how much private money is sloshing around on financial markets.
That's where the trillions are. But I would say most of that have gone to Asia and Latin America. Very little has reached Africa. Very, very small amount.
Why is that?
We have been speaking to a lot of investors. Africa doesn't really feature in even in the allocation matrix of most of the large capital. And there's been a bias towards an Africa project, despite the fact that we still have the lowest default rates on most project finance.
And Jude?
In 2019, McKinsey did a study that showed that private wealth managers, the money they're managing for pension funds, for teachers, hospitals, the total amount of assets under management was $11 trillion. That wealth managers with that amount of money claimed to have an interest in investing in Africa. So we have $11 trillion that is sitting on the sideline and supposedly claims to be interested in Africa. You can imagine the amount of good that volume of money can do.
Let's not imagine it. Let's hear some specifics. Take one city, Durban, South Africa. The climate questions, Jordan Dunbar spoke with the city's mayor at COP in Egypt.
I'm Xolisi Kaunda, the mayor of Ethekwini Municipality in Durban in South Africa. We are here to ensure that the city can better respond to the issues of climate change. In April, we experienced devastating floods, which washed away our infrastructure on water, electricity, power stations were washed away, roads, bridges, all that infrastructure.
Aid agencies describe this as one of the deadliest natural disasters in South Africa's recent history. 3 days of pounding rain drove floods and landslides, which wiped out thousands of homes and killed an estimated 448 people.
This is exactly the kind of freakish weather climate scientists say could become common unless we keep global warming in check.
The mayor told Jordan he needs help.
We need more funding.
If you had more funding, what else would you like to do within Durban in terms of climate change?
Adaptation, because how we build our infrastructure should then be developing the resilience whenever heavy floods visit the city. We need to expand the water canals, the river canals, so that when heavy rains come, we are able to channel water to where it belongs. So those are kind of interventions, but ensuring that we continue to plant more trees in the city so that we can absorb the carbon. And we want to reach a goal where we become the carbon neutral city.
Ian, this is a city hit hard. It's trying to build back better, but it doesn't have the resources. Can you think of other examples of places in Africa that are in this position, that are poised to do the right thing, as it were, but just don't have the money?
Absolutely. And it's just not cities, also rural roads. We have vulnerability in the way we are looking at infrastructure today. And we do need to change that. What we need is, we know the science, we know what to do. We need the money to flow into Africa for us to avert what's happening in the continent.
Someone who's doing her best to avert climate catastrophe is the mayor of Freetown, the capital of Sierra Leone.
I have come into office because of climate. I ran for office because of environment and sanitation. It's my number one priority.
Her name is Yvonne Akisoya, and she spoke to us about her experiences with climate finance.
We've received climate finance from GEF and the World Bank towards our Freetown, the Tree Town.
Wait, pause the tape. GEF? Are we talking about Jeff Bezos of Amazon? He's giving her money to plant trees?
Yeah, that's what I thought. And I just loved how she was like, Jeff, like first name terms with
my buddy.
I know. But actually, she explained it's an acronym, GEF. It's a body which runs a UN-backed climate fund.
GEF is the Green Environment Facility, GEF, Green Environment Facility.
Oh, I thought you said Jeff as in Jeff Bezos. I see.
No. We have had money from Jeff Bezos. But that was not what I was referring to. I was referring to the Green Environment Facility.
Okay.
The previous amounts were from the World Bank and GEF combined, about 1,800,000 thereabouts. From Bloomberg, it's $1 million.
Dollars.
Bezos, it's about, if I remember correctly, just under $500,000.
How did you find the whole process of getting climate finance? Were there lots of strings attached? Were they mainly grants, or did you get loans as well?
It has been unbelievably slow. These are not big amounts of money. Perhaps the biggest single number in this whole pot is from the World Bank for a sanitary landfill, which is roughly about 15 to 20 million, but this has been in the works for 4.5 years, and we're quite a long way away still from disbursement. So for me, it's not even about the strings. Let me see the strings. I'd be happy to see the strings if I could see the money first. You know, it really is just a dearth of available finance and incredibly small amounts relative to the size and scale of the problem, and also relative to speed, it's far too slow.
Mayor Akisoya also says it's too little. She reckons she needs $300 to $400 million to make Freetown ready for climate change. And guess how much she's got, Neil?
Well, I'm going to guess lower. She's not got enough. 50 million?
Much less than that. Something like $25 million.
Right. So that's like less than 10% of what she needs.
Yeah, exactly.
Okay. Jude Moore, you were Liberia's Minister of Public Works. Did you run into this kind of thing when you were in government, where you had these projects and you're like, oh, come on, show me the money, speed it up?
Yeah. And at least over the last decade,
Again and again, African countries, especially for basic infrastructure, would turn to the Chinese, not because the financing from China was cheaper, but simply because the financing was actually faster. And, you know, I was having flashbacks. Remember a few years ago, there was a massive collapse of a hill called Sugar Hill in Freetown, and a lot of people died. It was during the rainy season, it was flooding. Well, one of the things that the city of Freetown could have done was to actually put in place the kind of infrastructure would be required to prevent a recurrence of that. But if the city has to go through 4 years to access financing, so much so that by the time they access the financing, the problem has actually probably worsened. And so they now need more money than they needed before. And so this problem of a huge scale, small amounts of money, a significant amount of hoops to jump through, and the long time it takes to be able to have access to that money is only worsening the problem.
This is exactly the sort of thing that Mayor Aki Soya wants climate finance for. She wants to move people out of harm's way, where they're not at risk of being caught in landslides or by rising seas.
And this is also the kind of thing that you're involved in, Ayan. You're involved in making these kinds of investments. What are the strings the mayor was talking about?
So there are two types of strings. Is what do you need to do to get the money? And then the conditions come later, I think, as the Freetown mayor has said. So the conditions are that we have to provide a lot of data, scientific evidence, that the hazards that are happening are climate-induced, and that there is a way for us to solve it. So that's very, very cumbersome. It's expensive. So the whole process becomes highly elongated. That means you are now dealing with future disasters that could have been averted.
So I think it's fair to say there are a few issues when it comes to climate finance. It's slow to come, and when it does arrive, it may have to be paid back with interest.
So no wonder "show me the money" was the theme of this year's talks in Egypt. So how'd it go?
If there are no objections, it is so decided.
This was the moment when COP27's president, Sameh Shoukry, marked the end of the conference with the news of a deal on what's known as loss and damage.
You'd have thought there might have been a bit more robust applause. Developing countries have been lobbying for loss and damage for decades, basically money to pay for things already destroyed by climate change.
But the announcement was made at a terribly early hour on Sunday morning, a whole 2 days later than expected, and diplomats were working through the night, catching sleep on conference chairs.
But despite the hour, some managed to muster some enthusiasm. Listen to Zambia's environment minister, Collins Nzovu.
Excited, very, very excited. This is a very positive result for 1.3 billion Africans.
He wasn't alone.
Negotiators at UN's COP27 climate summit in Egypt have approved an historic deal on compensation for vulnerable nations.
When I heard the deal, because I'd left COP just before the deal was announced, and everybody was calling it historic, and I was like, well, how is this historic?
Peter Okwache from the BBC's Focus on Africa.
I mean, no one's explained the whole funding process, you know, but then I'm a journalist who needs to look at both sides of the story. So I called up a couple of people on the African continent, a couple of experts on climate change, and they were of the same opinion as I am. You know, yes, it's historic because loss and damage, they've been trying to get it onto the agenda for 30 years. And for the first time, it's made it there. And there's been an agreement that a fund should be established. But that's all it is. And then when you talk about loss and damage, who's going to benefit from the fund? So, for instance, if America, and I'm not saying America has done this, but if America says, OK, we're contributing $50 million to this fund, if there's a flood in Nigeria and there are wildfires in America, how are you going to divide that fund between the two? So, you know, so there's so much that has been left unsaid that for me, it's even more confusing than when it wasn't on the table.
Jude, the loss and damage deal, historic or confusing?
So I can understand both points. Historic first. If you listen to all of the conversations and interviews in the lead up to COP, it was clear that the Americans and the Europeans did not want any conversation about loss and damage. So the idea that they would finally agree to loss and damage is a triumph, But to the second point, we know nothing. There are no details. In 2009, the global north, the industrialized countries of the world, promised $100 billion annually. They've never delivered close to that. And so if the past is anything to go by, then you can begin to see why those who are more tempered in their response, we don't know yet if there's enough here yet for us to begin to celebrate.
Ayan, what do you think about, you know, that precedent from the 2009 announcement for the rich world to deliver $100 billion of climate finance a year by 2020? They failed to hit the target. Is there any reason to believe that the loss and damage fund will be any different?
I think I'm a little bit more skeptical because it's very difficult to put these mechanisms together that come out of a UN negotiation for them to operate and to be efficient and to be really dispersing the money. But it was historical because for most developing countries, it's an admission that they are suffering for something they have not caused. So I was surprised that it actually came through.
So we've heard that the money doesn't flow to Africa, and I guess you might be wondering why that is.
Well, a critique we hear from some investors and donors is that they're anxious about sending such huge sums of money to developing countries when it may end up being pocketed by corrupt officials.
This is something that came up in my conversation with the mayor of Freetown in Sierra Leone, Yvonne Akisoya.
I'm afraid this is a challenge, and what we do is work with models which promote transparency and accountability. And we invite our partners to co-create and co-implement with us where possible, because we've got nothing that we're hiding. So I really urge anyone and everyone thinking of coming on board to not hide behind corruption as an excuse. I know it's there. I want to encourage you to reach out and let's continue to work collectively to model the good in order for it to crowd out the bad.
Now at COP, Rwanda's president, Paul Kagame, talked about how outsiders view Africa's ability to spend money wisely.
Questioning whether Africa is ready to make use of climate finance should not be used as an excuse to justify inaction.
The speech caught the attention of the BBC's Peter Okwoche.
He said that it is not up to the Western countries to ask us what will we do with the money that we are being given to solve our pain. What we need is for you to provide the funds, and we know what to use them on. Let us fight climate change in the way that we see fit. Don't tell us that we have to go and buy 2 electric buses for our transport system when we need to provide better health care for people who have suffered from the effects of climate change.
The most valuable contribution that developed countries can make is to reduce their emissions faster while investing with Africa to build sustainable green power.
Reduce their emissions faster. Well, this most recent COP has been seen as a disappointment on that front, with many saying it failed to step up the pace of emission cuts and push to reduce the use of fossil fuels.
Some also saw even a watering down of the language used around fossil fuels.
Yeah, I saw this.
The phrase low emission and renewable energy was in the final deal, and critics said it signaled that fossil fuels could be considered part of a green energy future if they're used with something like carbon capture.
Which is still a commercially unproven technology that sucks planet warming gases out of the sky.
So, did Africa's COP deliver for Africa? We put that to Freetown's mayor.
I think there's some things that cannot be answered in a word, and I'm just not going to be able to do that in a nutshell. It was pluses and it was minuses. For me, my heart is heavy that there was not an explicit statement about the need to move away from fossil fuel. Because what Africa is facing is the impact of inadequate mitigation. The fact that the emissions are continuing to rise, which means the problems in Africa are going to continue. The droughts, the extreme weather events, the landslides, the flooding, not just in Africa, but globally. But we are really vulnerable. And so, yeah, my heart is heavy. Loss and damage. I'm glad that it was. The fund has been announced. How is the fund going to be funded? I'm not sure that's clear. Will it make a difference to the story that I just described? If I add up all of those amounts of money that we were describing and discussing earlier, if I take away the sanitary landfill World Bank project and I just say, you know, climate action, everything that we've done, we have not been able to secure and disburse $5 million over 4.5 years. That is just not good enough. One hopes that the fund will not be like the elusive $100 billion towards adaptation that was pronounced in earlier COPs in respect of Africa.
I don't think any of our guests would disagree with that.
And so with that, I turn to our listeners. What do you think? Did Africa's COP deliver for Africa? As Mayor Akisoya said, there's room for argument both ways. Let's hear your take. The email address is theclimatequestion@bbc.com.
And we're still offering bonus points to those of you who send a voice note.
Thank you to our guests, Ian Adam and Jude Moore, the BBC's Peter Okwueche, and to the team.
Researcher Natasha Fernandez, producers Georgia Cohn and Sophie Eastaw, series producer Alex Lewis, editor Richard Fenton-Smith, and our sound engineer this time was Graham Puttyfoot.
Hi, I'm Manny, host of World Football in Qatar, the podcast leading the conversation on the global game.
The 2022 Men's World Cup is underway.
As 32 nations dream of World Cup victory, we're going behind the scenes in Qatar, talking to the teams, the fans and people there for the tournament.
I think the team fed off the energy. There was a lot of Ecuador fans there.
I mean, it's huge. You represent something that's bigger than yourself.
It's a dream for all of us.
So we'll give everything on the pitch to make them proud.
That's World Football in Qatar from the BBC World Service.
It's a World Cup time. It's ready to go.
Find it wherever you get your BBC podcasts.